I guess if you were asked when America became polarized, the answer would vary depending on your age and what you've lived through and what you haven't. For leading historians Kevin Cruz and Julian Zelizer, they say it all started in 1974. In that one year, the nation was rocked by one major event after another. In terms of politics and economics, in their cultural and social relations, Americans have recently discovered we actually share little common ground with one another. Well, how did we get to that place? In their new book, Fault Lines, Cruz and Zelizer examine the persistent development of political, economic, racial, religious, and sexual divisions in modern America, as well as the cultural and technological changes that fostered and evolved from such divisions. Again, the name of the book is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, and it is a great pleasure to welcome the authors Kevin Cruz and Julian Zelizer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
The book is fascinating. It is published by Norton, and it is it's just amazing. I've been pouring through this over the last several weeks. So let us begin. There's a lot to talk about. Let's start with you, Kevin, as to why you wanted to write about this now and look at this particular time, beginning with 1974.
Yeah, well, this came out of a class that Julian and I taught together here at Princeton a couple times, and it was really an effort to think about this period as a discrete period in American history. You know, for so long, the period since the 1970s have always been kind of a postscript, like a coda in most history classes. And we thought actually the time had come, now that this span is about 40, 45 years, to really think of it as its own discrete period and not as kind of an afterthought to an earlier era. But what did this time mean on its own? And so we started with the class, and it led to this book.
So, Julian, what was happening in 1974 that really set this all up?
Well, the event of events is President Nixon's resignation in August of 1974. And that's an event that's significant on its own, obviously, to have a president step down. But it came as a culminating moment for many of the tensions and problems that had been taking place, you know, over a decade with Vietnam, with the beginning of the economy really moving in the wrong direction, including an energy crisis, and just with bigger questions over the legitimacy of many institutions that Americans had trusted. And so we thought and felt that starting with Nixon stepping down was a perfect place to launch us into the new era.
How much of this, Kevin, is a culmination of just how turbulent the 60s were? I mean, Vietnam, of course, Watergate, of course. But after going through so much of that, that you almost set yourself up for a period where things have to change in one way or another.
No, but yeah, that's absolutely true. And so even though the book, you know, technically starts in 1974, a lot of the early chapters fill in that backstory of the 60s, which really had radically changed not just the country's politics, but also its economics, racial and gender lines, the whole deal. And so there really is a period when the old institutions of the post-war era, which had really held the country together, there had always been fault lines, but these old institutions had held the country together. So you've got political parties that are much more ideologically diverse and also committed in some senses because of that to a sort of political centrism. You've got an economy that's thriving with the industrial economy running at top speed and a strong union movement holding it together. America feels, even though it's the height of the Cold War, feels largely secure in its place on the world stage. And all that really falls apart over the course of the late 60s and early 70s with Vietnam, with Watergate, with the kind of the white backlash of the civil rights movement and on and on. And it really is a moment in the 70s when a new order starts to take hold.
So, Julian, talk a little bit about that conservative movement and how it emerged and how ultimately it was formed and accepted by many people in this country.
That's really an important story of the 70s that we cover. And the movement included many different factions or components. It included a religious faction, which were religious activists and preachers who decided in the 1970s that becoming involved in politics would be necessary in order to change public policy and to change debate over issues such as the family or even debates over economic policy. It included parts of the Democratic Party that felt disaffected from where the party had moved. We talk about neoconservatives in the mid-70s who were Democrats, but on foreign policy, they really started to break both with Democrats and even with Republicans like Nixon and Ford, who they believed were too quick to appease or negotiate with the Soviet Union. And it also included the elements from Wall Street and business, which really wanted to pursue a revolution in tax policy and regulatory policy. And they all start coming together as the 70s unfold. They are a response to the crisis of institutions that's taking place. And Reagan's a crucial figure in 1980 because not only does he win election, but he brings this movement into power and changes the nature of the Republican Party and changes the nature of American politics more broadly.
So, Kevin, before we get into really that Reagan era, let's talk about the election of Jimmy Carter and what we saw in that election and even through his presidency of exactly what you're talking about of those fault lines going really at the beginning, but certainly during his administration.
Yeah, Carter's a really fascinating story. And so at first it seems like Carter is going to kind of erase the gloom and doom of the Nixon years and Ford, too. You know, Ford is clouded by Nixon's resignation because of the pardon. And it really does seem to be in the eyes of a lot of people, you know, a so-called corrupt bargain. It's I don't think that's true, but that's the general expectation. So both Nixon and Ford seem to be kind of bathing in this taint of corruption, right? And Carter comes in and promises to sweep this all clean. He runs as an outsider. He promises he's going to be, incredibly pure. He imposes new ethics. This is a sign of how far away this moment is. He puts his family's peanut farm in a blind trust because he doesn't want to have any hint that he might be profiting off the presidency. He has this great moment in the inaugural where he gets out of the limousine and he and Rosalynn Carter walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. The Secret Service is, of course, freaking out. But it's this moment that shows that they're regular people, right? And so briefly, there's this promise that Carter's going to sweep it all away. But in a lot of ways, the changes that we talk about across the book are there almost immediately. That illusion is dispelled. And Carter witnesses the rise of this powerful conservative movement that pushes back, that starts to fracture the Democratic Party. He's actually the one who brings conservative Christians into the political process really again. He's a born-again Christian himself, and so evangelicals and fundamentalists come out of the woodwork to vote for Carter in 76. They quickly feel like he's betrayed them, and by 1980 they have switched entirely almost to the other side.
Before we move, Julian, into the 80s and move away from the 70s, I would like to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment, that fight and the fault lines that that created. It is, I think, certainly not a coincidence that the top photo on your book cover is that of an event against the Equal Rights Amendment. So what was it about that not only had a great effect at that time, but continues as battles over gay and lesbian rights and ... continue?
Well, and the photo is of Phyllis Schlafly, who's a very prominent conservative activist, one of the most influential of the decade. And this is one of her central causes, fighting against the ERA. And the argument, there were many, but one that she made is it would put at a disadvantage housewives and threaten traditional ideas, as she defined them, of gender and of the family. And the fight over the ERA was a fight to stop the ERA, but it was also part of a bigger fight that was unfolding, again, in the aftermath of the 1960s, about how we thought of certain concepts, including the role of women in the family and the workplace, including sexuality, And this is part of how the conservative movement formed, not simply with a set of ideas they wanted to put forward, but in an effort to defend what they thought were ideas that were under attack. And so the ERA really became a hot point of contestation for a lot of these movement activists.
The name of the book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, it is published by Norton. Kevin Cruz and Julian Zelizer are our guests this morning. So, Kevin, let us talk about then moving into the 80s and the 8 years of President Reagan and the again, looking at a conservative movement, a conservative president, and what over 8 years, it was really the first time in a long time we had a presidency that could entrench itself and really make a mark.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so we talk that I think considerable length about the impact that Reagan has, not just on the federal government, but the country as a whole. In a lot of ways, he realizes what Carter had not been able to do, which is to really restore the American spirit. He does so not by focusing squarely on the problems that America has, as Carter had done with the so-called Malaise speech. Reagan just projects an air of confidence. You really see that in the 1984 campaign, which, as we know, dovetails with the Los Angeles Summer Olympics, where the Russians have boycotted, and America is clearly the winner, right? And that's that great Morning in America Again campaign, one of the most famous and incredibly positive campaign that he runs in 84. So Reagan definitely makes his mark, but one of the things that we talk about in the book is that it's not that conservatism comes in and wipes away liberalism. That's kind of a traditional story that's been told about the 80s. Instead, what we focus in on here are the way in which old liberal ideas and old democratic policies withstand the Reagan Revolution. Reagan tries to take on Social Security, for instance, and winds up failing badly. But also the way in which new liberal movements take root during the Reagan years, despite the total hostility of the Reagan movement. So to go back to the issue of gender and sexuality, the gay rights movement is really, I think, a great example here. If you look at the way in which the Reagan administration totally ignored the AIDS crisis, which was really plaguing the country throughout the early 80s, to the point where Larry Speaks, the White House spokesman, jokes about AIDS in a White House press briefing. You know, he literally laughs it off. That's a remarkable moment there. But despite that hostility, or actually probably because of that hostility, gay activists take the lead themselves, and through organizations like ACT UP, really have a confrontational approach to the Reagan administration and demand that they actually do something. And the change there is really remarkable. Reagan does finally come out and mention AIDS after his friend Rock Hudson comes down with it. But actually, if you look at what happens in the larger arc of the Republican Party, it's even more remarkable. By 2003, you've got George W. Bush, who is kind of Reagan's disciple, is actually leading the charge in proposing a massive program to fight AIDS on a global scale. So it's not just that conservatism swept across the country and destroyed everything in front of it. Liberalism survives in a lot of ways, and liberalism takes on new shapes, too.
So, I mean, you have this point. We were talking about Phyllis Schlafly before. You write about in the book, there's this point where the administration starts this PR campaign in schools and on TV about safe sex and in trying to deal with the AIDS crisis. Phyllis Schlafly accuses the president of encouraging third grade students to engage in safe sodomy. Good Lord. I have nothing else.
I just, I mean, there are a lot of tensions. There are a lot of look, right? The way we see Reagan, I think, we clearly want to stress the ways in which he changes policy in areas like taxes and regulation. It's very dramatic, and even in our public discourse. But there are all these tensions, and the ones Kevin talked about are really important if we want to truly understand his presidency, the ways in which he was going against liberals very often, or he found roadblocks to the Reagan Revolution. And often there were tensions within the conservative coalition, and that story with Schlafly is one of them. There are also many conservatives who are up in arms in the late part of his administration when he's negotiating with the Soviet Union, with Mikhail Gorbachev, about a historic arms agreement. And there are columnists from the right and figures such as Dick Cheney, who's a member of Congress then, who are absolutely livid. And so we try to bring all this back and to create a much more nuanced and richer portrait of this transformative presidency.
The presidency that lasts because his vice president is elected president in 1988. And we see he's a one-termer, but you have here again, you have 12 years of that Reagan-Bush agenda. Where did that bring our country and what we were ready for, ultimately, liberal change in 1992 with Bill Clinton?
Well, the changes are, I think, several to talk about here. One, in terms of politics, you can see that Reagan really does shift the landscape in a lot of ways in terms of what the Democrats wind up doing. Bill Clinton, in a lot of ways, was a response to the shifts that have been made under Reagan, the kind of the Democratic Leadership Council policies, really kind of adjusting the party to be friendlier, say, to Wall Street and things like that, are certainly changes that happen. In terms of the larger economy, though, what Clinton reckons with is really seen as some of the failures of Reaganomics. We've often forgotten about this now, but there was a recession under George H.W. Bush, in which many people saw the kind of the cost of Reaganomics coming home. And so when Clinton comes in, one of the first things he does, or the most significant thing he does, really, in 1993, is that new budget bill, which actually raises taxes on a lot of people at the higher end. And at the time, the Reaganites insist that this is going to be a disaster. It's going to ruin the country. But what actually happens is that we have a prolonged boom across the 90s.
So we only have a few minutes left, but I want to get to where we are now. One of the things that you talk about in the book of one of the real turning points here, Julian, is the attempted impeachment of Bill Clinton. It seems like there's nothing more that obviously it is going to create fault lines than between two parties, two ideologies, than that.
Absolutely. That's a key moment that takes place in 98 and 99. It's a moment that helps to exacerbate fault lines for sure, in that as a result of the attempted impeachment, the vote by the House to do this and then the Senate acquittal, the tensions between the parties become more severe. But a little like how we talk about President Trump, it's already being produced by a lot of the forces that are remaking the country. Obviously, the shift in the Republican Party that's taking place in the 90s, that's moving in a much more rightward direction, and a party that's more willing to be confrontational and to break institutional norms under figures like Newt Gingrich, who becomes Speaker in 94. This is part of how you end up with the impeachment. Cable television and online news is really taking form by the 1990s and drives a lot of the scandal and how it's covered and what stories get out. And we try to put the whole mix together. And even the response in the end, where it fizzles and it falls short, reflects some of the changing norms in American society about sexuality and what issues really should be part of politics and partisanship. And that's how we try to use a key moment like that to position it and also to explain where it comes from.
So in our moments left, give us an idea of the fault lines that where we are now, and I guess, I mean, we could just look at the shutdown of we have the longest government shutdown in the history of this country, and with no end in sight, and both sides digging in their heels and saying, okay, if it we'll fight till the end.
Yeah, you know, and that's what's really remarkable about this process. Again, we wrote most of this book well before President Trump was even a candidate, and yet we see under his watch all four of the big fault lines that we follow throughout the book really kind of coming to a head. So in terms of the political polarization, the shutdown is an amazing example of that. In terms of the economy, all the fight over free trade and also the free flow of people, the immigration fight is part of that. In terms of the line of racial divisions that we talk about, clearly the kind of the revival of white supremacy. We're seeing this right now with the flap over Steve King's comments, which are even roiling the Republican Party itself. I mean, the line of gender and sexuality. I mean, the Women's March, the Me Too movement, all these things are really still churning. So in a lot of ways, these lines that we start tracing in the 70s, we're still reckoning with them today.
Well, we are, and so I guess when it comes to the question I have is, will we always have fault lines, or I mean, is that just a nature of who we are, and that will always continue, or is there some way of repairing the damage that has been done since 1970?
I think we'll always have fault lines. The history of our democracy is one that's contested and that's full of friction and division. But the point where we start the book comes after a period where there were institutions that also pushed the other way. So the institutions we mentioned earlier, such as unions or such as a strong federal government, which provides a sort of commons, or a media that isn't simply partisan and fractured, but had common points of information, as we did in the 1960s, all of those can help to alleviate some of the tensions that will continue. And so the real question is, how do you get there? You're not going to recreate the past, but how do you reform and repair the different institutions we depend on so that they can achieve some of these goals? And it might be from a small thing, like not a small thing, but a more specific reform, like dealing with gerrymandering and trying to find ways to change the nature of districting, to bigger questions like, how can we develop different kinds of national media that pursue not partisan news, but actually much more objective forms of information delivery?
I love your phrase, common points of information. I mean, that that just seems so hard to attain right now, of something that seems to be very simple. He said this. No, he didn't. And then you show the tape, and no, I didn't say it. But so you can't. I mean, I don't know where to go with that if we can't come to an understanding of, well, this is what was done, and we all agree with that.
Yeah, that's the hard part of it. That's what we as historians reckon with, is that you know, facts do matter. And hopefully this book is a reminder that we have the facts on the record, and we can actually go look them up.
Well, for that, I thank you very, very much. The book is fascinating. It's really just an amazing read. I thank you so much for it. It is entitled Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. It is published by Norton. It is written by Kevin Cruz and Julian Zelizer, who are scholars. It grew out of their course created at Princeton University. Gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you so much for sharing with us.